That's a part of my own bias, and I suppose we all at one point in our history succumb to the little sin of bias. But that's not really true. I did deal with some of those weaknesses before. Today I'm going to talk about the black preacher, black power, and the black revolt, 1970. Now, for those of you who had not heard me before, we find it necessary to differentiate between colored preachers and Negro preachers and black preachers. And understanding that differentiation, we're talking about a rather special category of black preachers, by no means small in number now, but quite plentiful and quite active in a variety of ways. The task of the Christian church is to preach the gospel. And that's a statement that has reverberated through the ages and has in many ways become sort of crippling for those of us who were finally saddled with the responsibility of defining what we meant by gospel. You remember the last time we talked about black spiritualism, we dealt a little bit with escapism, for those of you who were here before, and I don't think that there are too many. The escapism which leads black preachers to lead black people away from confrontations with the viciousness of white racism here on earth, to doing the rather, I guess, futile thing of wrestling and arguing with God about it vis-a-vis the black spiritual or through some other word pictures that black preachers may be able to draw up. So I'm talking in all that I'll say this morning about the black preacher and the gospel. The gospel, as we understand it, being good news for a bad situation. And I suppose we're going to be defining that situation as we move along. Martin King saw clearly the meaning of the gospel. And I believe more than any single preacher, black or white, in America during the time that he lived and the time that he led the civil rights movement, which died 2 years before he did, he was a visible topography of what the gospel was all about. His was a good news in the midst of the most gosh-awful condition for people of color and more specifically, black people. Like Moses, he did not see his dream fulfilled, nor did he have a chance to visit bodily the promised land. But like Moses, he did climb the mountaintop. He looked over and he saw the promised land. As he said in what now has been called his funeral sermon, preached while he was fighting for the rights of garbage workers in Memphis, Tennessee, standing on the balcony in the same town, was killed. Now, following the death of Martin King, some new things started to happen to the black preacher. And these things, I suppose, were really a combination of having lost a rather effective and dynamic leader, probably one of the best rhetoricians of our time, and a man who did not feel the need to recruit people, but he would hang his message out there and allow people to relate to it, and many people did. Since that time, we combined that spirit with the spirit of Stokely Carmichael, the spirit of Eldridge Cleaver, and the spirit of many other so-called black militants of our time. So black churchmen now not only have the vision of Martin, but they also understand black power. And their message as it relates itself to black power has never been and will never be kill whitey, but it has to do rather with the affirmation of the creative and redemptive prowess of God and the ability of black churchmen to accept this as a fact and to lead their people into giving assent to the presence of that God in their context, and to ask again and again the proverbial, what the hell's wrong with being black, and to hear the answer, nothing at all. In fact, when contrasted with whiteness, everything is right with being black. The black churchman and his attempt to uncover the viciousness of racism in America today recognizes, first of all, the non-reconciliatory aspects of integration. It is non-reconciliatory, first of all, because black preachers have recognized that they, along with their people, have never been reconciled to themselves, their blackness, the texture of their hair, the thickness of their lips, the broadness of their noses, the seemingly inferior style of life, etc., totally incompatible with what they were told by white Christians was the proper, the good, and the Christian way of life. And so a group of 30 black churchmen, led by Jim Cohn and several others, developed a little book called Black Theology and Black Power. I believe that there may still be one or two copies left around the village here. There may be one or two in the bookstore. If not, some more, I believe, are on the way. And this little book then is sort of a 150 plus pages of resolution and a call to relevant action on the part of black churchmen. And also a recognition that Jesus Christ, if he is the same Christ who is preached and taught in white Western religion today, will desert under fire and has no place at all in the black revolution, basically because he will be fighting against his creators, against those who have made him what he is, and consequently the prognosis of defeat and ultimately justice and authentic interaction between human beings is practically nil. This particular text also resurrects again for us the pre-Civil War black preacher who had no trouble breaking the law when human life was at stake and when the good of their community called for it. It's really tragic that the Confessions of Nat Turner are, at least as they are recorded in the little book, Confessions of Nat Turner, are terribly biased ones because they were written by a white man who did not even understand white preachers, let alone black preachers. And consequently, the life of of Nat Turner has been transmuted into a thing of horrible evils, and consequently lost some of the real message of why it is that a black preacher like Nat Turner would lead the first effective slave revolt and participate in the killing of white slave masters. We're in a new era, but that era is very similar to the pre-Civil War era, because we recognize now more than we've ever recognized before the viciousness of removing the shackles from a man's arms and legs and placing them around his mind. And consequently, the black preacher in this era recognizes, one, that his people have no more cheeks to turn, and that they would rather die than be enslaved or submit to systemic programmatic genocide, which is in the cards for us and for other peoples of color in America today. So the idea of prayers on public occasions, over concern about tax exemptions, shying away from vital issues, exhortations to private morality, gutless spirituality, self-gratification and self-glorification has no part in the message of the black preacher, which we believe is an unequivocal 99% and 100% pure presentation of the gospel. To give you an idea of what I'm saying, and then I'll close because I still like to leave time for questions, especially when I hang some things out that people may need to get off of their chest right away. Recently, this appeared in the New York Times, and in the London Times, and in several countries around the world. It is called the Black Declaration of Independence. The architects of this Declaration of Independence are black preachers. I'm not going to bother to read all of the names there, but for those of you who are interested in how many Lutherans are there, there's only one. And for those of you who are interested in who he is, well, guess who? And this is a statement of black preachers to brothers and sisters of America. And the statement goes this way, and I read it here because the last time the full text will appear will probably be in this and maybe in some religious journals, which will not be at your disposal. As soon as this gets around, I suppose, it will be subjected to all sorts of editorializing and criticizing. So you're getting the first crack at it, and for those of you who've been in the village, or those of you who have not seen the need to read newspapers this summer, or for the writers who would have seen this, who took off, it's a rather rare treat, I suppose. When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for a people who were stolen from the lands of their fathers and transported into the most ruthless and brutal circumstances, 5,000 miles to a strange land, sold into dehumanizing slavery, emasculated, subjugated, exploited, and discriminated for 351 years. To call with finality a halt to such indignities and genocidal practices, by virtue of the laws of nature and of nature's God, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare their just grievances and the urgent and necessary redress thereof. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are not only created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness,
But that when this equality and these rights are deliberately and consistently refused, withheld, or abnegated, men are bound by self-respect and honor to rise up in righteous indignation to secure them. And whenever any form of government or any variety of established traditions and systems of the majority become destructive of freedom and of legitimate human rights, it is the right of the minorities to use every necessary and accessible means to protest and disrupt the machinery of oppression, and so to bring such general distress and discomfort upon the oppressor as to the offended minorities shall seem most appropriate and most likely to effect a proper adjustment of the society. Prudence indeed will dictate that such bold tactics should not be initiated for light and transient causes. And accordingly, the experience of white America has been that the descendants of the African citizens brought forcibly to these shores and to the shores of the Caribbean islands as slaves have been patient long past what can be expected of any human being so affronted and so abused. But when a long train of abuses and violence pursuing invariably the same object manifests a design to reduce them under absolute racist domination and injustice, it is their duty radically to confront such government or system of traditions and to provide under the aegis of a legitimate minority power and self-determination for their present relief and future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of black people in the United States of America, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to address this declaration to despotic white power, and to give due notice of their determined refusal to be any longer silenced by fear or flattery, or to be denied justice. The history of the treatment of black people in the United States is a history having in direct object the establishment and maintenance of racist tyranny over this people. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. And what follows now are facts as have been compiled by the Research Department of the National Committee of Black Churchmen. The United States has evaded compliance to laws, the most wholesome and necessary laws for the education of our children. The United States has caused us to be isolated in the most dilapidated and unhelpful sections of all cities. The United States has allowed election districts to be gerrymandered that black people find the right to representation in the legislature almost impossible of attainment. The United States has allowed the dissolution of school districts controlled by blacks when blacks opposed with manly firmness the white man's invasion on the rights of our people. The United States has created a multitude of public agencies and offices and sent into our community swarms of social workers, officers, and investigators to harass our people and to eat out their substance to feed the bureaucracy. The United States has kept in our ghettos, in times of peace, standing armies of police, ghettos is in quote here, state troopers and national guardsmen without the consent of our people. The United States has imposed taxes upon us without protecting our constitutional rights. The United States has constrained our black sons, taken captive in its armies, to bear arms against their black, brown, and yellow brothers, to be the executioners of these friends and brethren, or to fall themselves by their hands. The exploitation and injustice of the United States has excited domestic insurrection amongst us, and the United States has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our communities the merciless military establishment, whose known rule of control is an undistinguished shooting of all ages, sex, and conditions of black people. For being lynched, burned, tortured, harassed, and imprisoned without just cause. were being gunned down in the streets, in our churches, in our homes, in our apartments, and on our campuses by policemen and troops who are protected by a mock trial from punishment for any murders which they commit on the inhabitants of our community, for creating through racism and bigotry an unrelenting economic depression in the black community which wreaks havoc upon our men and disheartens our youth, for denying to most of us equal access to the better housing and education of the land, for having desecrated and torn down our humblest dwelling places under the pretense of urban renewal without replacing them at costs which we can afford. The United States has denied our personhood by refusing to teach our heritage and the magnificent contribution to the life, wealth, and growth of this nation which have been made by black people. In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered mainly by repeated injury. A nation whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a racially oppressive regime is unfit to receive the respect of a free people. Nor have we been wanting in attention to our white brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their structures of power to extend an unwarranted repressive control over us. We have reminded them of the circumstances of our captivity and the circumstances surrounding our settlement here. We have appealed to their vaunted justice and magnanimity. We have conjured them by the ties of our common humanity to disavow these injustices which would inevitably interrupt our connections and our correspondence. They have been deaf to the voice of justice and of humanity. We must therefore acquiesce in the necessity which hereby announces our firm commitment to the liberation of black people and hold the institutions, traditions, and systems of the United States as we hold the rest of the societies of mankind enemies when unjust and tyrannical, when just and free, friends. We therefore, the black people of the United States, in all parts of this nation, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the recessitude of our intentions, do in the name of our people and of our black heroes, and we list a whole bunch of them here, solemnly publish and declare that we shall be, and of right ought to be, free and independent from the injustice, exploitative control, institutionalized violence, and racism of white America. And that unless we receive full redress and relief from these humanities, we will move to renounce all allegiance to this nation and will refuse in every way to cooperate with the evil which is perpetrated upon ourselves and our communities. And for the support of this declaration, with the firm reliance on the protection of God, we mutually pledge to each other our lives and our fortunes and our sacred honor. This is, of course, statement from the National Committee of Black Churchmen on behalf of black people all over the United States. Now that gives you an idea of the mood of the black church, the mood of the black preacher. It gives you some idea of where we are going or where we are forced into going, and the prospects of that kind of movement is not a pleasant one. And for that, it was necessary then for us to have as marching orders for the move that we feel we must make in this country and in other parts of the world. South Africa is no exception to that general rule, as is some of the South Pacific Islands, to have for that the one ideology which we feel does not fail us, and that is the spirit of the man from Galilee and how we understand his movement in the four Gospels. Well, that's where black preachers are today. That's where black preachers are, who are represented by the top bishop in the AME Zion Church,
the AME Church, the CME Church, the black preachers in the American Baptist Convention, the black preachers in all other major white denominations, Presbyterian, Methodist, Lutheran, etc. And we commend then these thoughts, I suppose, to some discussion. One final word. Black preachers may be the last of the talkers in our black communities today. They may be the last. All right. Yes. We feel that if the definitions which were given to the terrible acts which Hitler did against the Jews was genocide, then that is also applicable in our case. When we see the numbers of our community being reduced the way they are being reduced. For example, there are some statistics that some of you are not even aware of, and of course we might want to shift the blame to someplace else. How many black children die each year of rat bites, for example? Or how many are maimed beyond any, they're maimed beyond usefulness to the society or to their community. How many children die from eating leaded paint from tenement dwellings in New York and Chicago and other big cities around the world? Little black children. Brought on, of course, when something like families of 16 are placed in tenement dwellings built for six people. How many black youth in the past year have been shot down? I mean, in places like Augusta, Georgia, and Jackson State, and what have you. And when you start adding up all of these figures, then it spells genocide to us as we see our numbers being reduced, at least in ratio and proportion, the same way Hitler cut out plans to reduce the Jews.
Well, this has been a national policy for a long time.
That's true too. Indians have been reduced now to 500,000. When there were upwards, I don't know, above 6,000-7,000. I don't know where the statistics are now. Somebody says when you take all the Indians from Canada and from south of the border here, there were 10-12 million Indians in this country, and they've been reduced now to about 500,000. And the only tribe that I know of that has survived and has not been broken up and almost totally emasculated is the Hopi Indian, who does not allow any white man to get near them, which is, I suppose, the one reason that they have survived.
I can think of some things that need to be done, and of course some of these things we have presented already in our Declaration of Independence, which came out incidentally on July 3rd, which is the day before July 4th. And I don't really know if the educational system that we have got today is compatible with the demand that poor people and black people are making. It's very interesting for us to note that a lot of tax money are being spent on some rather fashionable and expensive buildings on university campuses for the white kids to come and burn down, which leaves us kind of baffled at this point. But if I might offer some sort of broad general thing, we shift, as I've been trying to do in most of my lectures here, the responsibility of coming up to responsibleness in society away from black people, and we start talking about educating, which, at least as I use it, is synonymous with humanizing white people in this society. One, making them aware of what is happening, and two, creating the sort of climate where they can respond creatively to what obviously is going to become a thing which will break this very nation apart unless that happens, you see. Our appeal basically is to the enlightened self-interest of white people, at least as I see it now. It may be called doing the right thing for the wrong reason, which sort of cuts against the grain of those of us who are Christians, but we'll take it any way we can get it right now, you see.
Are you saying that black people should plan the education for black children, and we should only be concerned about enlightening our white friends?
We no longer trust white people to plan our education for us. We trusted them for these many years, and it was, and that trust has been violated, and violated horribly. White people cannot plan our education for us. They can participate in the planning of that education, vis-a-vis creative listening to those of us who know what our needs are, but they cannot, they can no longer plan it.
But this is hard to do when our communities aren't black and white, they are mixed. Now, I came from a school that probably was, I don't know, perhaps 60% black, 40% white, I don't know what the percentage is, but it's a mixture, and it's a community with a mixture. It isn't all one and all the other.
See, we must ask then, what color is the principal of that school? Okay. Then if, it seems to me that the 60% then of your student body has no representation in that office. Has no peer to look up to. And if we buy the majority-minority business, at least as it says majority rule thing, then any school where you've got 60% black students, a black man at least ought to be sharing the responsibility of power in the school. What color is the Board of Education?
They're both.
Which town are you talking about?
Minneapolis.
Well, I happen to know that Minneapolis has been paying a rather hefty sum to a man named Nathan Rice to advise them. Now, that's a good move, but they had to call Nathan Rice. Nathan Rice is a black preacher, by the way. He's the author of several books, Black Power and Urban Unrest, and Let's Work Together, and a few other pieces. Perhaps one of the most learned of our National Committee of Black Churchmen, and participated in the writing of the Declaration, by the way. Nathan Wright has raised some rather serious questions about how the power profile goes in the state of Minnesota and in the city of Minneapolis. And these questions have not been answered. So he is tempted at this point to take his $5,000 and go home, because of the non-response of the school systems in Minnesota to some of the things which he has cited. Among those things, one final statement. Among those things, you know, one of the real issues that have that's come up has been one, the removal of racist textbooks from the school system. As I'm sure you're familiar with that. Not only the blacks have pressed for this in Minnesota, but the red people also have been pressing for it. And their demands have been met with a lot of stalls and a lot of nice general sayings, but no concretized action. Most of the reaction to the demands have been sort of asphaltized, which means not entirely concrete, you know.
Why do you think you're so...
I think you would agree, if you just think through this, I think you would agree with me that these have been the responses.
Well, I'm not familiar with all that's gone on behind the scenes. I know that there are problems in that area.
Yeah, now I'm sounding like an expert on Minnesota. I suppose... But then that's the basic bane of our existence, is that we've got to try to keep up with all of it. We cannot leave a stone unturned, however the phrase goes. But the big problem has to do with how do you pull the machinery into a posture that's compatible with doing what ought to get done, and saving the lives and the psyche of thousands of black and red children in the state of Minnesota. And so far, the response has not been the kind of response which indicates or which breeds any trust at all in that area. Let me go to the gentleman behind me here.
So, you said you want to plan, Negroes want to plan the education of their children, but I don't understand why you think your children need an education that's different from my children. We're all living in the same country. So
well, I would agree. I would agree that blacks don't really need an education that's different from white children. What white children and black children need is the truth. And right now they are not getting the truth. They're getting some rather... I could cite chapters and verses, you know, starting with your Dick and Jane reader and ending with your history books. The Dick and Jane reader is no more than, if you take the pictures, for example, they are white children colored brown, you see. If you take your history books, then there's still the misguided adulation about George Washington and Abraham Lincoln and some of the other things which are untrue. And also the fact that thousands of contributors to the welfare and the growth of this nation have been left out. There are exceptions to the general rule, and I suppose... that's right.
Well, there's a teacher you should bust.
Yeah, maybe we should bust teachers like that instead of children, huh? He still had a question hanging, and I want to speak to the...
I have another question. In your Declaration of Independence listed a number of abuses. Have you felt any of those abuses personally here at Holden Valley?
Let's say, maybe I should refuse to answer that question on the grounds that it might be self-incriminating, considering the fact that I'm outnumbered here. I have no problem with acceptance, you know, here at Holden. Holden is sort of unreal. And I remember one pastor coming, John Tram was here last week, and he said that Holden could soften you up so much that once you hop on the boat and go down Lake Chelan, you're sort of psychologically and physically discombobulated when you get back to the real world. So to raise Holden as a prototype of acceptance, the comparisons may not be too important at this point. I could say something about that, but that's not really germane to what we want to get at here. My problem with acceptance in this village is minimal.
Well,
yes.
What is there in the wind that looks good, that looks positive? What if the person can grab onto it and say, this thing is where more effort will produce
Yeah, well, I see a lot of positiveness even in this session here, Lyle. You know, 10 years ago, this could not have happened. You know, I mean, the very fact that I am here talking with you ought to be a positive sign. But then I shouldn't have to say that it's a positive sign. That ought to be seen and understood. The very fact that we have not had restored, but the fact that we have methodically restored our vocal cords, along with our manhood and our ability, as I said, to give us into the presence of a God and a Christ in our context, is a hopeful sign, you see. But if one wants to talk about hopeful signs in America, then I must say we are reverting at this point. It's sort of like McLuhan says, we are, how does he put that thing? Umau, you're familiar with some of his stuff. He says we are driving into the future backwards. The rear view mirror thing, you know. There's a picture in his little book of a car going down the freeway, and in the rear view mirror there's the reflection of a stagecoach, you see. If you want some concrete examples of that, then check out Nixon's cabinet. Folks could say what they want to about Johnson. You know, Johnson did, at least as we understand it, have a pretty bad foreign relations thing. But his domestic program paralleled that of John Kennedy, which were three steps up from Dwight Eisenhower. It reflected itself in his cabinet and so forth. What color is Nixon's cabinet? You know, it looks to me like a picture of the Last Supper or guess who's coming to supper, you see. Even his expert on urban black affairs is a man named Moynihan, who comes out with this stupid statement advising Nixon that the best solution to the problems with black folks in America is benign neglect. Now that backs us up 150 years. Now, those are not hopeful signs when we look at domestic policy from Washington. And if that is the place from whence the issues of life for this country flow, then God help us. So I don't see any positive signs there. I see positive signs in isolated, self-started political action on the part of black people. But then I see the changes that they are put through. For example, the recent election in Newark. Those of you who followed it know darn well what that man had to go through. And of course, some folks say we will not elect a black man who talks with Leroy Jones, for example. You know, we will not elect a man who was set up for us by Leroy Jones. Same difference in Gary with Hatcher. The old established parties deserted these men. And the only instance where I can think of Democratic national committees and stuff moving to support a black mayor was in the case of Stokes in Cleveland. But then that's a different animal. You know, Stokes became and still is, and those of you who are sensitive to politics know it, a company Negro and not a black man. Some folks would say, well, you got a black senator in Washington. that lovely, sensible senator from Massachusetts, have we now? Have we? It's a rather serious question of whether we have black men with their full manhood in these positions, or whether we don't have lackeys for Strom Thurmond and somebody else. That's changing, however, because Eddie Brooke, along with the National Advancement of Colored People, have started to recognize that they are losing the black community, and that the country is breaking apart at the seams. And this is why even kindly old gentlemen like Spotswood, president of the NAACP, have launched some rather vicious attacks against the White House, if you've been reading your newspapers recently. So the hopeful signs that I see do not come from political power forces, so-called, in America, but I see them coming from the black community itself. For example, we are no longer a ghetto. Even the most updated novels and books cannot comprehend what has happened in the black community in the past 4 years. We are a community and not a ghetto. And if you want visible topographies and examples of ghettos, then check out those communities where you've got tract homes, green grass, and bird singing. Those are ghettos. Even if we buy the definition of ghetto which came from Warsaw. There was another question back here.
I didn't catch your differentiation of black, colored, Negro.
Yeah.
You guys are still slipping?
No.
Well, colored and Negro were definitions which white people gave us. Those are definitions. Colored is the word that we associate with signs on John's and drinking fountains and restaurants and things like this. That's the immediate association. Negro we associate with a watered down, rather unclear copy of white people. Blackness we associate with self-identity, pride in our color, pride in our culture, pride in our being, and total and complete self-definition, not dependent upon anything outside of the black condition. We use the word black not to connote skin color so much, but to connote a state of being or a state of the mind. Otherwise, I wouldn't fit into that, you see. Because as my black brothers say, you were nearly polluted. that's not reverse racism now, that's a joke. You see, the Afro-American is a definition which we accept, you see. In fact, that's the definition that's most used now by the black intellectuals who recognize that a brand new culture has emerged in this country, born right here in this country, and it is a not so strange mixture of both African and American style, culture.
Are all these, is all this terminology that is acceptable, is all that published for everybody on that?
Oh yeah, it's well published. Even in your paperback novel. Would you do that again?
Well, you referred to yourself, your comment was 97% right. You were 99. By the position that you're standing now. And the only other people that I know who stand in a similar position on the white of races who are shooting me down.
Mm-hmm.
That's the idea.
I suppose.
Your comment on the structure of Nixon's administration is very interesting, because there's an article in the latest Life about this, and it was brought about evidently by the criticism of Nixon's cabinet. I don't mean criticism by the blacks. I don't know who was criticizing. But it points out the one big top guy that Kennedy had, and the one big top guy, black guy, that Johnson had, and that Nixon has none. And then it showed the structure, the people that aren't known by name. In fact, unless you're a student of government, even their titles and their jobs are not known. And yet what he has there in many instances are capable, very learned, very knowledgeable black men. Now, if you've read that article, you're probably ready with, yeah, but they're all, and you've got a name for them.
No. I read the article and I did not say that. All I'm saying is that they have no power.
Yeah. Well, I only know one of them. That's because they drug him out of the state of Washington, where he was known here.
Yeah, that's right. You know. Very fine man. Good man, but he has no power. And may come back to Washington.
Well, but he's doing a job. I mean, your logic, you know, we could skip the 137.
The point is that he takes orders from the cabinet man.
Right. Well,
and that he is overruled by the cabinet people.
But this goes way back to the very first question here. We can skip the 137 echelons between the whoever is above the Board of Education and the mayor and the governor, and your final question then, who is President of the United States? And even if he doesn't come out with the right laws or the right statement, why then he isn't really black either. He just happens to be, you know, if he doesn't come out with the right program. So there's all the same question is always asked. If you get a good, positive answer to the first question, the second question is always, okay, who's above him? Because I don't want to talk about that anymore.
No, that's not true. There were very few questions raised by blacks about the Kennedy program. There were very few questions raised by blacks about Johnson's fulfillment of the Kennedy program. There were a lot of local questions raised, but we were at least seeing some hopeful signs. The question is whether or not Nixon has backed off of the program, whether he hedges on Southern education, whether he hedges and cuts in areas that affect white people, black people. You know, for example, like the Job Corps program, it's gone now. You know. Most of that was black people. Why? Well, we're going to replace it with something better. He calls it black capitalism. It doesn't make sense to us. Well, I'll just share it with you. The day that a white president, or any president, whatever his color is, recognizes the diverseness of culture in this society and arranges his cabinet that way is the day that we've started to solve our problems. And I'll go through them for you. The natural psychedelic mind of red people, there ought to be one on the cabinet, you see. The soul of black folk, there ought to be one on the cabinet. Religiosity of Jewish people, there ought to be one on the cabinet, you know. Close-knit family construct of the Oriental, there ought to be one on the cabinet. Strength and ingenuity and intellectual prowess of those who are addicted to the European gene therapy. Well, maybe there ought to be one on the cabinet, you know. Folks who can make tanks run off of water, or who can break the outer crust of space. Sure, let's have one on the cabinet, you see. And the president, no matter what color he is, can put out the light and look at his cabinet, which truly represents America, which is not a melting pot, but it's a nation of many people. And he could say, okay, fellas, let's do democracy. The day that that happens, we'll say, now you're making sense.
Well, you'll say that, but are the Oriental people, is that what they want? I mean, they want this structured cabinet?
Well, you see, we're sort of on the horns of a dilemma here.
in that we have no Orientals in the village. We have no red men in the village.
Well, but they're learned people.
We have no brown men in the village.
The Browns want it.
Well, I know the Browns want it, and I know there are Orientals in Chinatown who want it. If that is the largest Chinese community on the continental United States, I mean, within the, how do you say it? Well, there's a larger group in Vancouver, B.C., but the largest group outside of China itself is in San Francisco, and Chinatown is about ready now to become something other than a favorite tourist attraction thing for people who come from the East and other places. Sure, minority groups want it. Japanese want it, too. The Germans want it. Swedes want it, yes. Well, we would have a big cabinet, but it would be no bigger than that. It would be no bigger than the board of directors of your average corporation. Check it out. Couldn't be any bigger. Exactly. Well, that's all right with us, you know. We would certainly like to see the cabinet losing power. I mean, people cannot understand why I, for example, would get psychosomatic cramps every time I licked a stamp. You want to know why? Because the man who is the postmaster general was seen kicking black people in Montgomery, Alabama. His name is Blunt. Now, if that's what it takes to become postmaster general of the United States, then we are establishing a rather horrible precedent. It's like one's ability to wield an axe handle could make him governor of Georgia. You see. Now, are those the kind of people that the people want? Then, if that's true, sir, we should, like, hang our harps on the willows.
I think America, 200 years ago,
remember
old.
Are you asking me to look that far ahead? Yeah. We are aiming for authentic interaction between races without cost to their person. We are not talking about integration as integration has been defined. Integration meant becoming white. It meant accepting all of the folkways and mores of white people. That's insanity, at least as we see it. We then become much more susceptible to suicide and other barbaric things, you see. So we don't want to be integrated. We are, however, seeking a culture which takes into consideration, a situation which takes into consideration the diverseness of culture and the differences between, legitimate differences, created differences between ethnic groups in this country, so that all has a right to represent themselves. For example, the red people have a horrible time dealing with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Why? Because the Bureau of Indian Affairs, when the red people say, we want Alcatraz to belong to the Indian people, and we want the Indian people to decide what should be done with Alcatraz, the Bureau of Indian Affairs sends in its man, and he says, we'll make it a park, and we'll put some Indian statues in it. You see. I don't know whether it's going to be 200 years or what, but what we are working for is authentic interaction and dialogue between races in this country, and a complete destruction of the melting pot myth which white people still live with.
I wonder if elucidating that goal more clearly to white might not be a big step in the direction of accomplishing.
Well, seems to me we've been trying. Low these many years. You see, there's a big difference between reading newspapers and watching television and reading about black leaders and what they say and reading them. And I find that to be the basic bane of the existence of white people, is that, as this lady pointed out, they do not avail themselves to black people who have elected to use the vicarious means of paper and ink to communicate their
their known needs as well as their unknown ones. Well, I saw a hand back here before I saw yours. Yes, there is. Which one? The lady here? Okay, okay.
What do the black people think of what I heard people call, a token Negro? In other words, are you glad to get somebody in there just because they're black? I have this feeling that people elect people or appoint them and put them in place just because they are black, because I don't like that. I mean, they ought to be in there on their merit, and I don't think that's very good.
Who sets the criteria and who determines the merits is the question. We say put them in because they are black. Now that has all of the implications of faithfulness to the black condition, because they are black. You see, that's why we're condemned to partial communities, because we were black. That's why red people were placed on reservations, because they are red. That's why Japanese people were sent away to Lake Thule and other places for their own protection, of course, except that they didn't have their houses and their gardens when they came back, because they were yellow, you know. Well, I am a black person.
Yes, you are. And I'm an individual. But
you are a white person, aren't you?
Yes. But as a white person, I'm different than another white person. But what I'm trying to get at is, last year, there were headlines in our hometown paper, black teachers hired. In Ferguson, 77. We're poor. They didn't hire to us a black teacher. They hired a gal with practice taught there that we just thought was tremendous. And the spring when I was asked to work with a black, I said, I don't know anyone really personally except some children or friends of mine out there. And one of my staff friends turned to me and he said, you have coffee with Judy all the time, she's black, but I didn't speak of it. This is what I'm saying. You said you think he should be hired because he's black. And
Well, because he is black or she is black, he or she is in full possession of a rather unique ability, and that is to understand the black condition, and that is what he or she represents. You see, I get sort of confused at this point, because nobody ever raises questions. For example, when the newspaper headlines say, black man rapes 6-year-old white girl, or black man kills 20 white people, nobody ever says, well, why don't they just say a person did that? So we've got to have some balances on the other side, that's all. We're good folks. We are totally, totally capable of managing our affairs and representing our people, and the balances must be created. We want the recognition. To deny our blackness is to deny our personhood. To deny our blackness is to deny the creation. This is the way we were made. We accept that. Now, prior to this particular period, if you had called me black even, you'd have to kill me, because I didn't accept that because of what blackness connoted. Now blackness connotes something else. And as I said before, black power, black self-determination does not mean get whitey. It does not mean that. It does mean, however, that whitey will not stand in our way anymore. And we will not allow people to continue defining themselves in terms of who they are not, as opposed to who they really are. It's coffee time for those of you who want coffee. I'm willing to continue the discussion, but I don't want to deny anybody coffee.
Well, your answer to my question is that the black people do want people in anywhere they can get them, and they don't care how they get there, even if the white.
it's a beginning. You know, we recognize the inability of white people to determine who's qualified and who's not qualified. White people cannot do that. Because white people have never really gone through any real expense or time to understand black people, you know. Consequently, they must make appointments. However, you see, it would be terribly advantageous if white people would start taking cues from the black community about who they want to represent them. But these decisions are made by somebody else other than the black people themselves, you see.
Well, at the city level, I noticed in Seattle, I mean, that's coming right out. You're not just positions, but some of the most effective of the men. One of them, unfortunately, was killed. One or more blacks than has been learning and so forth on the council. Now, that city, that body does have the power in that city. And they are elected, and they're running consistently and have been elected.
Yeah, well, see Seattle.
Sam Smith and George Fleming and.
Sam Smith is
a I know quite a few black preachers in Seattle. In fact, Seattle now has our police chief.
Milwaukee's got our baseball team.
Yeah.
You want it back?
Gaines is our police chief.
From where?
From Oakland. The guy who came up to clean up the corruption in y'all's police department.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. Except that he can't even take care of his own police department. He's going to take on a town that's dying, like Seattle.
Is he black?
No, he's white. But, you know, we kind of hope that he'll stay in Seattle. We've got a very fine Missouri Senate police chief now that he's gone. So we kind of like him. We kind of hope he stays. But he won't, of course. Because we pay good salaries now at the Oakland Police Department, huh?
Who are some of the black people in Seattle that we should
meet with? Sam McKinney, a very, very capable black leader. I could think of a few more. Gil Lloyd. Those are two right away. I suppose that Seattle has this fair coming up, don't they?
Is
it on right now? Well, if you're going to go out, you know, it might help to visit the black exposition there, a black booth. There's some messages there for people.
Are you familiar with Harold P. Booker's work up in Seattle?
Yes. Yes. I also knew the Urban League man who was killed. Yeah, Pratt. Nobody knows who. Thanks, Sharon. Yeah. Nobody knows. Nobody knows who killed him, but they're still looking for black people.
The latest in the papers was that they have a theory that the guy who killed him was also killed.
The letters came out last week. That
yeah.
They're not going to mention any names, but they were on the because they had nothing to arrest them on. But they do suspect that a murder victim. Sometime later, and he was white, a young
that's right.
man. Was, you know, and they thought he might be the one.
Yeah.
They say not, but they stop.
That's right, but up to this point, they've been looking for black young people.
Why?
Because only black young people would assassinate the leader of the Urban League. That's why. That's been the thing that they've been operating under. Look for young black men. They're the ones who killed him. When the black community said, we believe, and you know this, we believe that some white assassin was brought in here to kill off our black leadership. And they may be right.
Well,
Again, I'm not an expert on Seattle, but at least the contacts that I have had betray the fact that the inability of those in power to listen creatively and responsibly to the black community created the problems that you've got there now. And the whole question of representation in power positions is a legitimate question, because they have never been given to people of color in Seattle. You mean the Oriental fellow? The Oriental fellow? I don't know him. You might ask some of the black preachers there, like Jim Smith or Lloyd or Sam McKinney.
And they don't just have an individual opinion like most people. They really have the feel of the black community.
They have the feel of the black community. They are pastors in the black community.
And not just the black Christian community.
Well, that's almost all the black community. You see, we are almost...
back the day before yesterday.
Yes, we are almost all Christians. And we can make that stick. We are almost all church members. As I said, except for those of us who went to white universities and learned how to be atheists. Yes, statistically that's true. The black church is still the only voluntary classless institution in American society.
Well,
bar none. And it has been the black church which provided the motive force for the genesis of the black revolt today in the persons of Martin King. And of course, reverting back as far as Nat Turner and Daniel Payne and some of the other black minister clerical leaders during that period.
Well, you know, the comments that you made to my kids the other day, you know, and this is a thing that we all say when something like this comes up and somebody stirs it, moves it, stirs it up, and what can I do? And this is a comment that my kids made to Willie. And we're involved in northern Wisconsin, a little group with a group of Indians about some 70 miles away. We're involved, I think, on a somewhat superficial basis, but involved anyway. And Willie made the comment, why don't you bring me some company next year to the kids? You know, why don't you bring some of those Indian kids up here? I thought that was a good idea then, but I'm beginning to think less of it every day, because Holden is what it is. I think it would be sort of like making them go through Queen for a day. You know, I don't know if that'd be good or not.
Well, it seems to me that the red people, if presented with a choice, must be the ones to decide.
Yeah. Okay.
When Harv and the mayor and the vice mayor invited me to come here, I had to decide. Of course I asked, you know, my community whether or not they could trust me up here. You know, of course I did. And I could come. And I really believe that this may be the place. I'm not necessarily talking about the fireplace. Sharon knows my opinion, my feelings about this fireplace. You know, it is a place for gamesmanship and intellectual gymnastics, you know, but out here, you know, in the village, something different happens, and I find that it's worth it to be here. But then the red people would have to make those choices themselves. The important thing is that they do not feel that they are denied access to the place, you see, but that they are presented themselves with a choice. So I share your feeling And I think I understand where you're coming from, but by the same token, the choice still must be left to the red people once they're presented with it.
And maybe in asking, we might be more involved with them.
It's very possible, yes. Very possible. What was it? It was last year, wasn't it, Herb? There were two black youngsters in the village from Ghana. They came into the village with Martin Marty. And they had very, very little difficulty either making their presence known or destroying some of the stereotypes that some of the people who frequent Holden might have about African people, you know. So that in itself is worth something. I mean, somebody here says, we don't even see any black people. I would have to guess that there are people who come to this place whose contact with people of color is minimal. And they need that sort of contact.
What about this business that when you think about
if you're bringing them into a white community, I think you are martyring them.
As a white family, can I bring them into a black community?
Sure. Everybody's welcome in the black community. That's one of the grand myths that's been circulating about the black community, you know. We have never restricted anybody from our community.
In other words, make him feel black. Is it possible to make him feel and be proud?
It is not possible for white people to make a black child feel black. It is possible, however, for white people to participate in the creation of a climate where natural self-awareness can take place on the part of a black child. I mean, you can picture a mother and father standing in front of a, you know, little black kid and looking down at him and saying, hey, son, it's about time your mother and I told you that you were adopted. Well, you know, that I really think that there are certain givens at that point, you know. I do not discourage the adoption of children across racial lines. I do, however, want parents to understand exactly what they're doing and that they are not adding to their own group, you know, by adopting a child across racial lines, but they are giving that child a chance, one, for self-discovery, you know, and two, a chance that he might not have had ordinarily, but to give the child a chance to survive the system at the expense of his isness, you know, is a horrible thing.
It's not easy to reason. You have to be willing to share your black child with your black family.
Well, that's right. That's right. She makes a point. You must be willing to share your child with a black family, or share your child with an Indian family, or share your child with a Chicano family. You see?
We have a child who's both.
Do you live near red people?
No, it's all white.
You mean you don't have anybody of color close to you? Yeah, that's right. You've got a brother-in-law who's close to you. That's right.
Well, then everyone has to decide for themselves in their own situation. We're quite frankly worried about what will happen when we leave that community, because we'll be leaving the whole thing that has made it possible for our family. And naturally, our personal with a black child is going to determine where we go on to. It won't just be what church my husband's called to.
and we have to consider this now too, because we've taken on a responsibility beyond what the normal pastor has to consider when he moves.
You see, I quite frankly have a great deal of admiration for the intestinal fortitude of white people who elect now to become black, because whether you like it or not, that's what happens to you. You know, if you adopt an Indian, you're an Indian. If you adopt a black person, you're a black person. You know, if you adopt an Oriental, you're an Oriental, because that's what the society will do for you, whether you like it or not. Well, it's at that point that the black community says we are ready to conduct massive baptisms for all of those who wish to convert and come on over. We need all we can get, and we're not so color conscious as to feel that conversion cannot take place. And the black community has always been, historically, the easiest one to get into.
You know, that's not the feeling we get, though. Maybe it's because of the media.
Mm-hmm.
It's the feeling that they hate us and don't want us around.
We don't hate white people. Read Eldridge Cleaver on hate. It's called Soul on Ice. Eldridge Cleaver states it very simply. My brothers, we cannot hate, because the price of hating is loving oneself less. And if we're going to continue to be in love with ourselves, we cannot hate. Well, another guy said it before Eldridge, but he didn't say it that way. His name was Jesus. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. Yourself being the only instrument by which you can measure your love for another man. So I'd say read black people as opposed to reading about them. I'm repeating that so that I'm sure you got it. Name of the book is Soul on Ice. It's been banned by a lot of school systems because they say that it's got dirty language in it. Well, it's no dirtier than some of the epistles of Paul and some of the words of Jesus. If they are, Herb Lottich would agree that there are certain sections of the Greek that he cannot translate into English because it's too dirty. You know.
But then the Greeks are dirty.
Yeah, Greeks are dirty, that's right. That's blacks and whites together.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
the Greeks,
yeah, Greeks are dirty.
That's right.
They are not migrants that have come and gone. They are a very decided community. There is a railroad track in Yakima that divides the community.
See, most folks don't know it, but it was a black man that settled this section of the country.
True.
Named Washington.
Absolutely.
A black man settled this country.
And that's why Washington High School down in the east end of Yakima is called Washington High School. It isn't George Washington they're thinking about. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Where
did you get that? Out of history books in Washington?
Black friends.
Oh, thank you. just so that...
Here.
Yeah, just so that my stereotyping is reinforced at this point.
Right, it is.
One does not like to be wrong, you know. And I've read stories of the history of Washington, and you don't get it.
You're right. You don't. Not even in the predominantly black community.
Yeah. Now, there was a black man who settled here and fought Indians much better than whites and kept them away from his land. He was an oppressor, but he was black. You know, we're proud of the fact that we had some settlers in our ranks, too, you know.
You guys against us, too?
Well, the buffalo soldiers were infamous. The Indians claimed that they couldn't... See, one red brother said, even when we got y'all drunk and tried to scalp you, we couldn't get it off because... That woolly hair, we couldn't get a good grip on it, you know. And that's why the black soldiers were named by the Indians buffalo soldiers, because their hair resembled the buffalo hide. But you see, this is not in history,
as opposed to pony soldiers.
See, Custer was quite easy. They got his quick, you know. They grabbed that long yellow hair, and right off it came, you know. But that, you know, just to, Harv was, did you have another question, Harv, when
you...
You see, what you say again is true. Black militants recognize probably much better than those who try to lie to y'all about what we're all about. They recognize authentic persons much better, much quicker. And that's why you're not having any problem with acceptance on the part of the so-called black militants in your community, you know. They recognize that anybody who's got the nerve to do something like that has got to be either off his rocker or deeply committed to some religious experience which they can't understand, you see. So black people stand in awe of that. And it's true in our town, too. You know, there's a lot of, there's more adoption of children across racial lines, I guess, in our community than in any other section of the United States right now. Berkeley, you know, has become, I think, a sort of prototype of what authentic interaction between races ought to be in the school system and everything else. And so you find a lot of that. And the acceptance level always goes up in the black community and tends to diminish in the white community.
Well, as a single issue, though, this is interesting, you know, and there are cross-line adoptions and so forth, but why is there such a need for this? When you consider adoption, you are presented with the fact that there are so many more.
Blacks and reds?
And yellows. In other words, you're faced with this. I mean, why isn't the, and especially since they're so much more heavily Christian than white, why the adoption, the care of little children and older people, this is a Christian concept. Why isn't this being done even more heavily?
By whom? White people?
No.
By black people?
By the people who correspond with the children.
Just a minute, what are you trying to say now?
We've got a very simple matter of supply and demand here.
He's saying it's so easy, really, and it is, to go out and adopt a black baby, or a yellow baby, or maybe a red baby, although the Indians aren't going to give them up that easy, than it is to adopt a white baby. Well, I'd like to answer part of that from our social structure. The white social structure is infinitely different from the black social structure. And when you say social worker, what color do you think of? You think of a white man. And I think that this is so highly organized in the white community that maybe this is one of the reasons that it does take a year and a half to 2 years to adopt a white baby, because there's so much damn paperwork you have to go through, so many stupid interviews you have to go through, so many office holders.
Yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful. You're wonderful. That you have to go through. Till finally, you're too old to have a kid. This doesn't exist, really.
With the black community. Right.
So maybe the black community is more Christian, even though there are more.
Again, of course, it becomes a very simple problem. For example, I remember when I was growing up, the brown baby boom hit this country, you know. And black soldiers were accused of impregnating every white German girl available in Germany. And so so the brown baby boom happened. And every black community was called upon to adopt a brown baby. Well, there were a lot of black families, families, sergeants and upwards, you know, that adopted brown babies. But we just couldn't afford to. We didn't have any money.
Yeah, that's fine. But we don't have to go across the sea. Right here, we have a ratio of nationalities and colors. And now, I didn't think about this matter of the social agency, that they didn't exist. But still, there are social agencies. I look at it as serving the community. There are black couples who want to adopt, and there are Orientals, and on and on and on. There are babies, and the babies come, and they keep coming. There's a matter to be taken care of, and this agency has a job. That is all agencies. There are many of them. They've got a job of placing these with adoptive parents. And you have a preponderance of children who have a nationality, whether mixed race, what have you, up for adoption constantly. Now, look, you've got the percentage of people, of adults, is, you know, equally or unequally the same. Aren't they adopting, or don't they accept the agency? Is it a white structure? Is this your answer?
The agency is a white structure, and that, you know, the first.
Well, but look, to be
first part of the answer that Lou gave is correct. You know, that's where it's going now. In fact, we're becoming terribly fearful of having our population decreased by having children sucked into the white community. Another one of the things is the whole welfare state, you see, and the sort of things that that happen as a result of that. A lot of fathers, black fathers, for example, prior to the 60s, would get their wives pregnant and leave home so that they could get welfare because fathers didn't get jobs, you see, and they would keep coming back and getting them pregnant. Again and again and again.
Well, that's not unique with black.
In order to get more welfare. Well, you know, it is, at least from our vantage point, you see. We are the recipients of welfare in this country. There's no question about that.
Yeah, but it has nothing to do with marriage. These turnkey projects are loaded with the women, whether they're divorcees. It doesn't matter. They can be single, divorcees, or married. And even if they're married, it doesn't relate to who the father was. They just keep having children.
And we did not have at our disposal things like Florence Crittenden homes either. And we still don't.
You don't need them as much.
What's that?
No, not as much.
Well, but look,
black women have done quite well in rearing.
Yeah, but you've got a child that is half white, half black. You just agreed and enlightened us here that is considered a black child. There had to be either a black woman or a black man involved there. What I'm asking for the third time here is we have all these children. Now, that's a fact. Now, you have, what is it, 10 or 20% of a community or 50% is black. I mean, the adults are black. And you have so much white or oriental. And you have these children, which are all or part black. Why aren't they being adopted by the black people?
Because the black people don't have the money and the wherewithal, and they're not acquainted enough with the systemic way it's done to do it.
Besides, they've already social workers in the past, and even personal questions by adoption agency are going to approve the intimidation for many of them because of the conditions. And it costs, my gosh, it costs. In order to get leave, we had to go down to San Diego at our own expense and bring them back at our own expense. I wish people would join us writing legislators.
Right. It's not a matter of
Wait a minute. We have all these children up here, and you have to go to San Diego.
No, we do not. And you don't understand the problem if you are only from Washington or Oregon. Yeah. Washington, Oregon, and Minnesota have such
a small group of minority people. We wanted a child between the ages of 2 and 5. We said we would take any child that needed a home, but we wanted a boy between the ages of 2 and 5. That eliminated minority children in the state of Washington and Oregon, who almost all of whom are adopted by the time they are 2. In order to find a child that really needed a home that hadn't even been looked at, we had to go through a central agency, which has just been started within the last 3 years in New York State. We were immediately given the names of 4 children in Kentucky, Quebec, New York City, and San Diego, because these were children who were considered exceptionally intelligent, and yet they were considered unadopted because of race. So we chose San Diego, because that was the closest. And that's how we came to get Lee. But we waited for almost a year for a child. We rejected absolutely no child whatsoever. The only ones that were available over 2 years of age were Catholic, or they were groups of children where they wanted 2 or 3 adopted. We didn't feel we could take more than 1 at a time. And or they were children who were of low mentality, and they felt it would be a disservice to our own children as well as to the adopted child who was in a family where there was average intelligence and hope for advanced education. So this is a misconception that the Pacific Northwest has about the number of minority race children that are available out here. And this is why we can't understand the floods and floods of them that are available in other parts of the country.
The same thing happened up in the store when we got a child from Colorado.
Yeah, your little,
you said, who are you? Yeah. Who are you?
Lou Raymond.
Anyway, you said something about all that red tape and all that time. It took, yeah. We adopted 2 children. It took 7 months for the first one and 2 weeks for the second one.
God, where'd you go?
Seattle.
Wonderful.
And so we don't understand that.
And this is fine. If we had wanted a white baby.
Janet?
And we're old, too.
Janet, how old is your sister? She's got 1 child. How long have they been working to adopt another baby?
1 year.
1 year now. And it looks in Wisconsin.
Of course, things have changed a little now. This was Leonard 2 years ago. But in the last 2 years,
and,
standing in line now.
I'd have to have her and her husband here to tell you how many hours of interviews they've gone through, how many tons of papers have been filled out, refilled out, refilled out, over and over and over again.
That's the old way.
To the point where they're...
Oh, no, where do you go?
To the point where they're thinking of hanging it all up. I see the other side of the... I see the other side of the coin, too. I see the other side of the coin, too, you know? I see this from somebody that wants to adopt a baby, but I see the other side of the coin. I take care of unwed mothers. I'm a physician in Wisconsin. And I take care of unwed mothers, and they, you know, some gal, 15, 16, 17 years old, comes in, and she's pregnant, and she doesn't know what the heck to do, so it's quite obvious to me what she's going to do. She's going to be pregnant for 8 months or so. That problem is easily set. But then I am at a complete loss as to what to tell her, what agency to tell her to go see. Because I know these agencies, and I've dealt with them before. I haven't been pregnant, but some other people have, and have dealt with them through me. And I get this feedback back from them. It is just as expensive for an unwed mother to go through one of these agencies and to adopt, to give this baby, that give hell she pays them to take the baby off her hands. And I, with all the workers in the field, in that field, I'm beginning to think that I'm going to go into the adoption racket, because it looks like there's good money in it. Looks like there's good money in it. And what's your investment? A desk? About that many pieces of paper? And maybe a tape recorder. Great. And then advertise. I'm bitter. Extremely so.
I just sat in on a meeting that was and they had a new form that was going to send out. The old form, you know, had a lot of biases in it, I guess. And you had to have a pastor fill out, for both of our children. We had to have a pastor fill out a great long report on it.
Mm-hmm.
And my gynecologist, too. You know, why can't this woman have any children?
That
but we threw that
point.
Out.
Right.
Yeah.
That's beside
that
the
has
point.
Been thrown out. Now all you need is to know that you're a member of the church and that you want a baby and you can provide a loving, warm home.
That's
all.
There's only one question they should ask.
They're going to stay together.
There's only one question they should ask the person that wants to adopt a baby. What's love? What is love? It's the only question they should ask.
But now we're getting away from it.
Well, that's all right. You know, it seems to me that there's a rather heavy number of people who have adopted or who are interested in adoption here, and you know, and I'm perfectly willing to let it go. I see people around here, and I know that most of you have either adopted or thinking about it. So, you know, it's your time. You know, if you.
Almost like,
yeah, that's right. It's almost
hey,
like being on the ground.
We just moved
ground.
Out of Cornelia.
Yeah. Yeah, people with some interest are pursuing their interest, huh?
When we were deciding to adopt, I thought they'd ask us, would you be willing to adopt a black child? And so you think about it. And I'm not. I haven't been. Because, you know, that, like you said, that's a
big
commitment. And you don't know. Could I be big enough to do it? I'm not sure that I could be. We have friends that did. We have friends. I have to admit that these friends adopted me because they had a black child. So she was coming to visit me. You know, I thought, I didn't think black. I thought brown. Curly hair, not. And here came this little kid. She was really black and kinky, you know. And I was kind of shocked. But then she was treated her just like any other child, which is what she should have been.
It was very interesting for me to find my own things up here in my head when she came and said it was done. But I'm not sure I'd be able to do it. In light of your statement a while back about the desire of the black people to maintain and to appreciate and to live within the black culture, not try to integrate it in a way that comes homogenous. How do you look upon the adoption of black children into white families? Does this destroy the idea of maintaining the black culture?
No. As I said before, I admire the intestinal fortitude of those who adopt across racial lines because they are taking on two responsibilities. One, the responsibility of rearing a child. No, one, the responsibility of rearing a black child. And two, the responsibility of rearing a child. You see? It could become time-consuming as well as expensive in being faithful to the condition out of which that child came, in recognizing that society as it is so constructed now does not allow for cross-pollinization of culture and ideas, and so you must arrange for some rather artificial means for this to happen. And I use the word artificial not in the bad sense, but in the good sense. You know, artificial in the sense that it's a work of art, and it requires some thinking and some commitment to work that out. That's different from superficiality, you know. That sort of thing is, and most white parents who are adopting black kids in the post-black consciousness era, and most parents who are adopting red children in the post-red consciousness era recognize that. Even if they're not told by social workers, they get informed somehow that there is a two-pronged responsibility involved in the adoption of a minority group's child. Harv, you and I talked about this a little bit last year, I believe, you know, with, concerning your child, you know. What should I do, you know? Does the child grow up in a white family? And if you'll remember my response, no, that child must at some point have, you know, extreme contact with Indian people. It's the only way that that the child can grow up to be a whole person, is that it appreciates the uniqueness of both its cultures. And it is a mixture of two cultures, but each culture keeps its identity. It's American and it's Indian. or American and black, or, you know. You see, if the day should come, and I suppose it will, if the country remains, we may adopt a white child, you know.
Yeah.
If we do this, you know, black consciousness informs us that it's sinful and criminal of us to deny that white child its whiteness. You see, but to allow it to mix authentically and genuinely the two cultures. Part of the problem, though, has to do with this myth about the inferiority of one and the superiority of the other, you know, and the basic denial of the existence of equal cultures as it relates itself to people of color is a problem that we've got, you know, is that when a white family adopts a black child, it is adopting it up into something. Well, that's, you know, it's adopting a child of color into a thing that we define as white insanity, characterized by suicides from the Golden Gate Bridge and other things. And you have to understand that, which is not to deny the fact that there are some sane white people inside of the white society, you know. Well, we hope that those who would adopt are sane ones.
Seems like it should be black people that decide whether white couples should adopt black children, because they're the ones who can tell whether
Well, yes, you know, she pointed this out, you know, white people, if you take a poll of any white community and ask, what kind of child should we adopt? Well, it's for sure that the idea of adopting a black child ain't going to come into the heads of those people, you know. Well, if you're thinking about adopting a black child, then the black community is where you've got to go for acceptance. That's where you've got to go.
It seems like maybe it's a good idea for white to adopt black, in that the whites, if they're really truly sincere, would have to delve into black culture and history and all of that.
This is what we pointed out.
Would
this is why. Yeah,
papers?
This is why she knows who settled Washington. You know, I doubt
the
if. State? Yeah, the state of Washington here. Yeah.
Sure, but what's his name, Bush?
You see, the whole point has to do with getting, yeah, with being taught by black people some of the truth of history and truth about the culture, generally. So it does mean that black people have got to have more than just, you know, some sort of casual understanding of the black condition. They've got to know it as much as they can intellectually, and then feel it as much as they can emotionally. Well, they will, should they adopt a black child. Because there's something remarkable even about black children. There's something different about them, as I'm sure you've sensed already. They are not white children. Now, they can be eventually programmed white, you know, through a whole series of ecclesiastical and cultural sheep dips. You know, it's like processing a photograph, you know, or something, you see. And pretty soon the memory is gone. But there's something, you know, there's some emotional content bred into a black child that most geneticists can't really get at. It's something that we call soul. Yeah. Social ostracism. Well, you've tried, and you have, let's say, benefited yourself. You see, it's not the white people who chased out. They are not the losers. You see, that's what we mean when we say, if a man is a Christian, then let him deny himself whiteness, take up his cross blackness, and follow me to the black community. That's the safest place in the world to be right now.
I'll give you an example of that, too. When Bob Kennedy came to Oakland, some of us, I happened to be one of the co-chairmen for his campaign there, and he came to Oakland, and the first place he stopped was the Masonic Temple. They had a rally there, and then he was scheduled to come to a black church in West Oakland. Well, there was a marked difference in the way he arrived at the Masonic Temple and the way he arrived in the black community, you see. Well, 10 or 15 motorcycle policemen preceded him, and four or five prowl cars followed him, all with helmets on, shotguns showing, etc. And I never will forget Bobby when he stepped out of the car that night. He looked around and he saw this army of policemen around this church, and he said, "What the hell are these people doing here? Get them out of here. Don't they know that I'm safer here than I am in a white community?" The next night, he was shot to death in the Ambassador Hotel. You see, there's a grand myth about the black community. And for me, it's the safest place in America right now. And for a lot of other people it is, huh?
Is that myth on purpose, or is it...
Oh, it has the same diabolical purposes that the whole history thing has, huh? It serves to frighten one group enough as it relates itself to another group as to drive them insane enough to kill them all.
Is that something that happens, or is it a plot by somebody?
It's built into the fabric of a demonic racist system that you and I are living under right now, living in. Part of the system. That's what white racism is. It's an institutionalized thing built into the culture, and it really started when some white folks dressed up like Indians and dumped England's tea in the ocean, had a big riot in this country afterwards. Otherwise, there would have been no reason for them dressing up like Indians, you see. Well, yeah, you know, I mean, it's all right to say that it was a bunch of Masons, but, you know, I'd sort of rest my case that they were white folks, whether they were Masons or not.
Well, you're fortunate you have a safe place. I don't know that the white has any safe place. And so we sit here and hear all this yammering all the time about the problems of the black, and yet today we have gone through and learned about the fact that you are almost entirely a Christian group or community. We can't say that. And you talk about all of the bad that's gone on, and of course it's all been done and structured by the whites. But the whites, that isn't very descriptive of anyone. Is it that they're white? I mean, they're all over the world white, and they have all sorts of backgrounds and heritages and histories and cultures and all this, and it comes to a very young country, and we've been melting for years, and we're still melting, and people are pouring in, and that's... There's not much identification in being white.
Oh, but there is. Check your television sometimes and see.
Well, what am I going to check on?
First of all, ask whether or not there might not be an advantage in your culture to being blonde when Lady Clairol elects to afflict women with other colors of hair with certain paranoia about the color of their hair. Or when Lady Clairol decides to continue the trickery, find out whether or not it might not be advantageous to be a redhead. When it does more than suggest to you that you ought to be a redhead at least once in your life, you see. And then finally, the brunettes, after having appealed to Lady Clairol, and now Lady Clairol says, you know, comes on with something for brunettes only, you know. This is...
Well, that's just another way of... That's just another small area of criticizing the whole country, though, and then pointing out that it's white people that have done it. If someone wants to be led along that way, if a brunette wants to dye her hair blonde, that's her privilege. I mean, I couldn't care any less.
Well, I do.
You know, they got the black hair is a lot better than this old gray stuff that we're getting, and they've got greats like Duke Snyder and Joe DiMaggio up there saying, "Man, it really works for me, and this is wonderful." Now, if my brother or my father wants to do that, that's their privilege. I've seen those commercials. If you got a mind, you can take it or leave it.
That does something to me, though. They are denying their uniqueness.
I'm sorry.
I think you've been talking about it all.
This is why I can't... You see, I cannot agree with people who draw down the mask. In fact, I can't trust them. I am frightened by those kind of people.
who pulled down the masks and who continue to emasculate themselves in order to become something that they are not. Those people are frustrating terribly creation and redemption. They are denying the whole creation process. It may not bother you, and you may say it's their privilege, but I say that, you know, those people need pastoral counseling.
Oh, it bothers me.
Because it's symptomatic. You see, it's symptomatic of something else, you see.
Yeah, the profit motive and all that, but again, that's here.
Your women's liberation group, and watch it, they're growing. And once they come off of
it. How did they get to be my women? I don't associate with them. You see, you've just proven.
Some white man want to speak to that?
you know what you're
That's another perfect example of how you're so safe.
Huh?
That's another perfect example of how you're so safe.
You don't have a women's list.
You make sure, you know, as long as you can find something where there's no black people involved, then you can immediately sit back and say, you guys handle it. You've got a problem.
No, we're here to help you. If you ask us for help.
I had a question about
yes, sir.
The exam instructor. Maybe you correct any biases or stereotypes I have. But first, my impression is that, you know, the exam instructor has been very located back in the late days, but there was no exam instructor. And it's been further promulgated by the welfare system, as you pointed out. Many others, too, were also pointed out in the question on how black men should be grasping for his national identity. And do you see a change occurring in this, or too soon to do this?
Oh, yes, I see. I see a decided change. Will you be here next week? I'm sorry, next week. I've changed my schedule and decided to do a thing on sex and racism before the day that I'm leaving the village. And there are some rather interesting things that, Umhau, this is your time, isn't it?